Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello. Welcome to another episode of Ancient Office Hours by the Ozymandias Project. Trireme Transit is now boarding for all new and returning passengers. Now departing, present ponderings. Next stop is Ancient Office Hours at a library lost in the sands of time.
Hey everyone, and welcome to episode 65 of Ancient Office Hours. This week, my guest is Dr. Jonathan Hall, a professor of classics at the University of Chicago. His early research was focused on the cultural and social history of ancient Greece, with a particular emphasis on the construction, meaning, and functions of ethnic identity among Greek communities. His most recent book is Reclaiming the Past, Argos and Its Archaeological Heritage in the Modern Era. He is also the author of a series of articles and chapters concerning the early polis, Greek colonization, and cultural identities. In this episode, we talked about how PhD programs in the US and UK have changed, why people have historically thought race and ethnicity are the same thing, whether the Dorian invasion was a real historical event, and how to navigate different research methodologies. I hope you enjoy this episode, and if you like what you hear, please give us a 5-star rating and review us on Apple or Spotify. You can also subscribe to our Patreon, as this will allow us to reach more people and make more exciting ancient world content. Enjoy! Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. I really appreciate you taking the time. So I want to just start us off and hopefully ask what I hope will be a pretty simple question, which is, how did you get into classics and ancient history? It's such a niche subject, so I'm always very curious by how people fall into it.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Lexi. It's great to talk to you. By now, you've heard so many people describe this journey that you've probably identified, I suspect it's only about three different patterns. And I correspond to the sort of lifeway that is really accidental, I mean, i.e. not due to many conscious choices. I was brought up and educated in the United Kingdom, and I was fortunate enough to win a scholarship to a public school, which, as you probably know, in Britain means the complete opposite to what a public school means in the States. And so from age 11, Latin was mandatory. You know, that just wasn't up for discussion. At age 12, technically, we had a choice between ancient Greek and German. And I wanted to study German. I just thought it was more relevant, more useful, and so on. It turned out the choice wasn't actually mine to make. The school made it for me, and they assigned me to ancient Greek because, in their view, my Latin was marginally better than my French. So I ended up doing these two languages, and I'm not sure I especially distinguished myself at them, but I guess I just was worse at other subjects. So when it came to A-levels, the last 2 years of high school in the UK, I went into the classical sixth form, as it's called, and took exams in Latin, Greek, ancient history, to which I added music. And about half of the pupils in the classical sixth were encouraged to apply to Oxford, and so I did that. But my aim to get to Oxford was partly just to be there. I mean, I wasn't terribly excited about studying classics there, but what I did want to study was law. I wanted a profession in the law. And the fact of the matter was that statistically speaking, it was easier to get accepted at Oxford if you applied to classics than if you applied directly to law. So that's what I did. My plan was I'll do the first five terms, almost 2 years of classics, and then I'll switch. I'll say, you know, classics isn't for me. I want a career in the law and so on. And well, so the five terms passed and I thought, well, okay, I'll stick with this. I'll get a degree in classics and then I'll, you know, after graduating, I'll convert to law. And for those last seven terms, we had to choose two out of three subjects. And the subjects were literature, philosophy, and ancient history. And I, this is ironic now, but I didn't want to study ancient history, right? I'd done it at A level. And I found it pretty boring. You know, Charles Hignett's History of the Athenian Constitution is not a scintillating read on the best of days. And I really couldn't care less who was standing next to whom at the Battle of Plataea. And all of the history we did at school was all political and military and so on. So I wanted to do philosophy and literature. But for a variety of reasons, I guess the short story is it turned out that I wasn't that good at philosophy. So I did end up doing ancient history. We didn't have a tutor in ancient history at my college, so I was sent out. And this is one of those moments, again, I'm sure this is a common trope to many of your guests' stories about this. I had the fortune to be hooked up with a brilliant teacher. Who was Nicholas Purcell, who's now the Camden Professor of Roman History at Oxford. And he is a Romanist primarily, but he also has wide-ranging interests, including in early Greece, which was what really interested me. And it was a type of history I'd never experienced before, you know, social history, cultural history, economic history. But also the term that I arrived, Nicholas started something called the New Initiative, which was designed to make ancient historians aware of the possibilities and enrichment to their studies that archaeology could provide. And it's that interest in archaeology that I think has also remained a sort of fixed feature in most of my scholarship.
Wow. I would say it's more common, I think, to, well, maybe not more common, but I've definitely heard a lot of people approach classics from wanting to go into a different field and then sort of get stuck and say, you know, it's not that bad. Okay, I'll stay. I like it. And have a good mentor and say, all right, I'm sticking with it. So, but it is interesting. Yeah, I don't know. Is it as common in the UK, do you think, as it is in the US for people who have an eye on law to end up in classics? Because I know here in the States, it's a very common double major that they encourage people to do. Is it also a popular suggestion in the UK?
No, less popular, I think, because the practice in the United States, of course, is to get a bachelor's degree at a liberal arts college or a university, but then to go to law school to specialize. Whereas everything in the UK is earlier. You specialize far earlier. So most people who go into law actually read law as their degree subject at the BA. Had I stuck with classics and then gone into law, I would have actually gone to law school for a year. But most people would have had a head start on that.
Yeah, I think I find that a lot of my British friends find this concept of our pre-anything tracks in the US to be very, very strange. Pre-med, pre-law, people are like, what? Why do you need that? Yeah, you know, I suppose it's just different way that education goes. But in your describing of basically coming into classics, not wanting to stick, and then finally finding something amazing that did interest you, how did you go about in grad school sort of picking your specialty, your area of emphasis? Because obviously, it's a bit frustrating because I found it frustrating when talking to professors about potentially going on and doing something. They would always say, you know, okay, well, you have to sort of paint with broad brush strokes. Oh, but then you do need to find something quite niche and small. And can you do that? Can you find this balance? And I was like, I don't know. I don't know what I like. I just like a large swath of things. So how did you navigate that process?
So, yeah, I know that this is a topic of an earlier discussion you've had on this podcast, particularly framed around the personal statement in graduate applications. Because on the one hand, an admissions committee wants to see, okay, you have some sort of idea about what you want to study, right? But on the other hand, you know, that's a little narrow-minded, isn't it? I mean, if you come into a graduate program, you say, this is what I want to do, then that's going to close off all sorts of other avenues that might have actually been more appropriate or more interesting. Everything, again, is different in Britain. The PhD is shorter. I mean, American PhDs are now becoming shorter. But, you know, when I was chairing the classics department, you know, back in the first decade of this century, we had people on the books who'd been doing their PhDs for 21 years or something, right? Now, in Britain, it's really, really short. So you actually, and there's no coursework. Or, I mean, there is now if you do an MPhil, but in the old days, if you go straight into a PhD, there is no coursework. Basically, the day you arrive, you're supposed to start working on your dissertation. So you need to know what that dissertation is going to be. And fortunately, I did, and I decided that I wanted to study ethnicity in Greece.
Oh, goodness. I have heard that the programs are short and they are very intense because, I mean, you're only doing a PhD. You only get, what, 3-4 years of funded work in the UK?
Yeah, I think it may now be 4, but in those days it was 3, yeah.
Okay. So I'm curious because I don't get to talk to a lot of people who've come through a different system, you know, if you're a young student, you're trying to just figure out what system you might want to go into. I mean, I think a lot of people with especially the economic situation today might look at the UK European systems and say, oh, it's shorter, it's less time. I could be through it and just get my PhD versus I know from talking to friends that there are really great advantages to the American system. So as someone who's working in the American system, but who's come up through a completely different one, you know, is there like a substantial difference now? Have they gotten closer? You know, why should someone choose one system or the other? Is it personal preference? Like, how does a young person navigate this decision who's basically balancing life and money and all these other things?
I think it is largely personal preference. And it really depends on how prepared or how well-versed you feel in classical culture when you start your PhD. I mean, if you had the advantage of taking a lot of classics-related subjects at your undergraduate college, then perhaps you don't need an extra 2 years of coursework at the PhD level. If, on the other hand, you came to classics late, I mean, there are plenty of people who don't actually declare their classics major until, you know, their third year or so, then it might be useful to get the US system of having some additional coursework. I think, you know, certainly there is an advantage, or for those people who consider it an advantage, I mean, in taking less time to complete your PhD. But again, I would say that they're becoming a little closer now because most American universities are really trying to reduce their time to degree. I think it is the case that you're likely to be much better funded in the US. I don't know what the rates are now in the UK, but I remember that I had to live off £2,000 a year, right? And it wasn't back in the Middle Ages, right? So even allowing for inflation and so on, I mean, that wasn't tuition. That was just maintenance, of course, but stipend or so on. But I think, some people think about it, they make a calculation in terms of employability. I mean, the advantages of a UK degree, a UK PhD, are perhaps that you can find employment in both the US and the UK, or at least you can when the employment market is in a good position or better position. So that might give people a slight advantage. But, you know, as you suggest, I think it really is a matter of personal preference and what works best for you. There is no doubt that the UK system is less structured. So you need to be really self-disciplined, especially, you know, you're working you're working on a subject that's supposed to be innovative, right? So therefore, your main supervisor may have some expertise, but if they know everything about it, then you haven't chosen a subject that's innovative enough. So as I say, in the UK, you know, you really have to sort of get going as soon as you start. And it's a lot of working on your own. There's a lot more sort of mentorship and pedagogical structure in the US. But again, you know, some people prefer a hands. I certainly prefer a more hands-off approach.
It's so interesting because it sounds a little like the decision for that I made when considering master's programs, because I was told, yes, a lot of master's programs, they are very sort of hands-on. They lead you as much as they can to success and to guide you. And I chose to do a one-year master's program in Athens, Greece, in Europe, and it was barely structured. I mean, they were like, okay, you show up and here's your class and here's your test. But other than that, it's completely self-directed. So I can see where, yeah, it would really come down to, okay, well, do I want someone who basically is on me all the time or just says, okay, go off and present me with your finished product? So I feel like that's its own level of stress that you would choose to put on yourself. But, you know, hey, I have friends who work really well with saying, yeah, don't bother me. I know what I'm going to do. You tell me I can do it and I'll do it. And now I want to get a little into your area of expertise, what you did study. So what was it about, like, the social history and the culture of ancient Greece that drew you so much to it? Because obviously that's a lot. So was it something like specific that you wanted to hone in on, or are you more like big picture and you wanted to understand things sort of in context and relation to each other?
You know, I am interested in the bigger picture, but in terms of my early research, it was really more focused on ethnicity, which is both a social and a cultural feature of any historical society. Actually, I mean, the reason why I got involved in that is pretty banal. It was no great design. It proved to be particularly serendipitous that I started it when I did. But it all started, I had a fellowship to travel to Greece in 1986. And what I wanted to do was study the history and archaeology of a place called Trizena in the Arglid region. This is ancient Troezene, where Euripides' Hippolytus is set. And I kept on reading in the secondary literature this sort of dictum that it was following Pausanias, that originally the population of this city, of this area, had been Ionian. And then at some point after the supposed date of the Trojan War, Dorians streamed in and sort of took over all the institutions. And I was just sort of standing there, or sitting there, I guess, reading this and sort of scratching my head and trying to think, well, okay, but how did this actually happen on the ground, right? I mean, did these Ionians, did they hang around? And if so, what sort of position did they occupy in society after that? And what does it even mean to think of yourself as Ionian or Dorian in the early Iron Age? So this it's a very sort of specific case study that got me thinking more broadly about what ethnicity meant in the ancient world. And as I said, it was a particularly appropriate time. About a decade earlier, ethnicity had suddenly become a hot topic in social anthropology, largely due to the realization that this great pipe dream of the melting pot in America hadn't succeeded, and the ethnic minorities weren't going anywhere. Mm. And then, you know, obviously things come to classics a little bit later. But a few years before I started my doctoral research, Edith Hall brought out her book on Inventing the Barbarian, which employed a lot of current social anthropological theory. My friend and colleague Kathy Morgan, who used to be a director at the British School at Athens, was also working on similar issues and had generated a bibliography. So you know, I managed to sort of join in part of the energy, the enthusiasm of that subject, with this particular focus on how ethnicity worked in Greece.
Oh, that's so cool. I vaguely remember hearing about that location only because I did like a day trip to Poros one day, and I think I saw like coin deposits and other things. And I remember turning to my friend and saying, wow, I don't remember this at all.
Funnily enough, I first got to visit Troezene when I went on a family trip to Poros, yes.
Wow. Okay, yeah. I was like, do things come from there to the other close islands, Aegina or Stepsis or these other, or is Poros like where most of the stuff comes from?
No, I mean, well, so Poros has a small museum, which has actually recently been renovated, and it has material from the Sanctuary of Poseidon, which is right at the top of the island of Poros. But it also has material from Troezene, because Troezene doesn't have its own museum. So that's why, and it's not that far. I mean, you just head on to the mainland and take a short bus ride.
Okay, that makes a lot more sense. So, and I'm very curious by, I mean, I don't really know many friends now who have chosen to go in and study ethnicity in ancient Greece, but I think a lot of people don't really think about, you know, what are the layers there? What does that mean to study? Because I've noticed a trend in talking with young people today, when they think of issues of race and ethnicity, the only thing they think about is difference in terms of either skin color or like culture. So like the ancient Persians and the Greeks or the Egyptians, because they clearly looked different. You know, would you say, is that an accurate way for students now to be thinking about it? Or should we be thinking about it in a completely different way? Because obviously, I think that there's race and ethnicity, while very similar and there's a ton of overlap, I don't think that they're the same. But I'm really interested by, like, why do students basically put them together and only think about them that way when thinking about the ancient world?
Yeah, that's such a good question. And it's the answer, I guess, is pretty complicated. I mean, part of it, I think, is just due to the history of scholarship in America, right? Where racial issues are obviously always of relevance, but also in Europe, you know, as part of the decolonization project. But, you know, ethnicity is really collective identity that's constructed using a variety of different traits, of which one is physical appearance. And it seems to me that nowadays, when most people talk about race, they are actually, as you say, they're really talking about color, which is just one type. I mean, there used to be this idea that race was race was to ethnicity as biological sex was to gender, right? The former is biological and the other is sort of sociological, and it's all constructed. I don't think anyone really believes that anymore, because actually, if you look back at the way the term race has been used, it's just as constructed as anything that we associate with ethnicity. So ethnicity, I think, is perhaps the broader category. But for very valid reasons, race just has a more immediate purchase, right? It just seems inherently more relevant, because we are also we're also dealing with ethnic issues, and particularly in Europe, where and especially the Balkans, let's say, where you have had some very bloody wars between ethnic groups that effectively look the same. Right, they may practice different religions, they may speak different languages. Effectively, though, they look the same. So ethnicity is I would say a broader category, and race is in some ways a rather narrower category, but not any less important for that.
And it's interesting because it does affect, because people. Well, I took one class, so it's not like I'm a great expert or anything. But I was noticing when talking about and analyzing two cultures that were very distinct, but like geographically close, and so we associate them being very similar. One thing I noticed living in Greece the past year and a half or whatever is when talking about like ancient Cyprus, let's say, people don't really see a distinction. They're like, just lump them in with the Greeks. They're basically not different. That's, you know, let's just consider Cyprus another basically Greek island. And so it's very interesting just to see how we basically interpret these things. And I've noticed that goes back to even looking at civilizations in early Greece. I mean, looking at, there's that age old debate, right, over the Mycenaeans and the Minoans, who was actually Greek, who was not Greek, are they ethnically Greek, are they racially Greek? So, you know, is that something that you've come across? Is that actually something people are still really debating, whether Mycenaean, Minoan, are they ethnically the same? Are they different? Are they?
And I think actually it's a topic that I think is being discussed a little bit more in certain corners of Greek academia right now. I mean, you know, there've been a bunch of ancient DNA studies that have come out fairly recently, which people have got very excited by, trying to show the origins of these people. And, you know, to be honest, I'm not entirely persuaded that the DNA evidence is telling us anything different from what we thought we already knew, which is that the language that the Mycenaeans spoke was an early form of Greek, and that the language that the Minoans spoke was not, was some other language entirely. Wow. Something we've suspected for a long time, and I think has become especially apparent now in the most recent excavations at Pylos. There is a great deal of contact and probably intermarriage between the Mycenaeans and the Minoans, and so that's an issue that I think is attracting a lot of attention at present. Although I should say I'm not a prehistorian, but
I mean, I think it's fascinating. Although, as someone who's interested in early Greek communities, I did want to ask, why do you think people are? I mean, obviously, a lot of people study all different periods of Greece, which is normal. I mean, it's all very interesting. But why is there this, like, super fascination? And I've noticed this fascination even with, like, people who are not in classics professionally, just, like, friends who like ancient Greece casually. There's this very deep fascination with Bronze Age collapse and all these these early communities and, you know, oh, they were doing so well, and then they just poofed out of existence. So is it like a human fascination with just like mysterious things?
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. Everyone likes a mystery, right? And I think if the Mycenaean palatial system had collapsed and been immediately replaced by something, perhaps there would be a little less attention. But the fact that you have this sort of period that itself has become highly contested in recent decades, you know, we used to call it the Dark Age. That's considered politically incorrect now because we know so much about it. But to be honest, everything we know about it suggests that, yeah, things are a lot worse than they had been, or at least prosperity has disappeared. The sort of prosperity that was enjoyed by the Mycenaeans has disappeared, and it wouldn't be until the sort of 8th century that you sort of recover that level of wealth. So I think the combination of the collapse and then what originally looked like 3 or 4 centuries of nothingness. I mean, as I said, we do know now more about it, but still, those things in combination, I mean, they make for a great mystery. So it's a whodunit, right? What was responsible for the collapse of the Mycenaean civilization? And of course, the current example is the current answer is a whole lot of things, right? The things that are all tied together. There's no one single unicausal explanation for it.
And where do you stand on this theory of the Dorian invasion? Like, were the Dorians real? I mean, in popular stories and circles, I mean, to the layman, I know a lot of people think, oh, well, they're said to be these like mythical descendants of Hercules or something like that, right? So they came down and they invaded Greece and everything just went boom. But as someone who actually looks at these things, you know, were they real? Like, if they were they actually Greek? Where do you stand on that?
Well, they were real in terms of what we might call social reality. Right. Meaning that by the 5th century, there are cities, especially in the Peloponnese, Argos, Corinth, Sparta, but also on Crete, Rhodes and the other Dodecanesian islands. And these communities think of themselves as Dorians, And they think that they are descended from people who originally migrated from somewhere. I mean, the accounts differ, but from somewhere in central or northern Greece. So there is a reality to being Dorian in the 5th century. Now, the question was there actually a Dorian migration? All right. Because the Greeks, of course, being very curious, had a story for everything, right? I mean, this is partly myths, but partly also traditions. I mean, these are the traditions that explain if there are Dorians in these places in the 5th century, how did they get there? When did they get there? And so we have these literary traditions that you mentioned. The Dorians are actually led by the descendants of Heracles. So they're not quite the same, but the descendants of Heracles serve as their leaders and bring them down into the Peloponnese, and then they spread out throughout the southern Aegean. And so since the 19th century, scholars have tried to find the linguistic or the material reflexes of this migration, or actually in the sources, it's phrased as an invasion. So they wanted to prove the historicity of these stories about the Dorians by finding their kind of material calling card, if you like. And you can do that. You can do that to a certain extent with language, but there are a set of dialects that are more similar to one another than they are to some other dialects, and we've often called them the Doric or the West Greek dialect group. But this, of course, assumes that all linguistic similarities are inherited longitudinally, shall we say, rather than spread or borrowed or imitated latitudinally. So that's one problem. The attempt to try to prove archaeologically the arrival of Dorians has basically ended up in a dead end. When I started my doctoral dissertation, actually, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to find the material reflex of the Dorians in Argos. But there had recently been a study which tried to connect the Dorians with a particular single burial in the cist grave. And I realized pretty early on that that didn't work at all. So I started searching for all sorts of other material imprints of this invasion and couldn't find them. So I then had to spend the rest of my doctoral research trying to figure out why I couldn't find them. And obviously, by turning to the social anthropological literature, when you realize that the ethnicity is constructed, and when you think more about the nature of early Greek history and traditions, and you realize that what purport to be traditions are really functioning to explain how things are in the present. This old idea that there's no smoke without a fire, right? Or that all of these traditions must have a nugget of truth. They may, but they don't have to. There's no necessity for any of these things to have a nugget of truth. And so I actually went back to these literary traditions again about the arrival of the Dorians. And I managed to, I suppose it was a type of structuralist analysis, but I managed to sort of deconstruct them and show that actually what we call the tradition on the Dorian migration is an amalgamation of different, sometimes contradictory stories. And so they clearly, at a certain point where people wanted to form links of affinity with one another, they said, well, we act like a big family, we're Dorians, blah, blah, blah. And at that point, they start inventing these stories to account for why they consider themselves to be Dorians. But these stories take slightly different forms in depending on where they're actually invented and what purposes they're serving. And then someone at a later date, if it's Ephorus or if it's Apollodorus, they try to rationalize, they try to jam them all together into a single narrative. But you can actually pick it apart and see the different original strands in that.
So what I'm hearing is it sounds like it's one big methodological nightmare to try to accurately prove that they existed or didn't exist.
It is. But actually, methodology is also something that I've focused on in my middle career, I would say. And I actually find it fun. I mean, even if you have to throw your hands up in the air and say, we don't know, I think, just going into the sort of historian's laboratory and sort of figuring through all these different pieces of evidence and the most appropriate methodology to apply to each is just fun. And it really, really shows, I think, the active nature of the historian. I think too often you know, when we see documentaries on PBS or National Geographic or the History, well, not the History Channel, because they only show things about aliens now, but other channels. I mean, there's this idea that history is out there and historians are just people who have very good memories or the ability to serve as raconteurs who can sort of relay this information to everyone. But in a sense, all they're doing really is regurgitating. And so if you take a history course at either high school or college, all you're going to be doing is learning stuff and regurgitating. That's not what history is at all, right? And so when you actually get into method and what are the appropriate methods with regard to different sorts of evidence in different historical contexts, I think that's when history really becomes exciting. You get to be the detective, right?
I mean, I couldn't agree more. I would love to do more. And actually, that reminded me, for my listeners who, and I believe a lot, are not familiar with how to do methodology within something like ancient history, because I think when I first heard the word before I got into academia, sort of, I only associated it, for whatever reason, with science. I thought, oh, okay, you say methodology, and I think we do a science experiment in a lab, and that is, you know, it's in its box. But when it comes to, like, studying actual methodology within historical cycle, and there are so many different ways to do it, I think people just kind of don't know what that means. So as someone who has looked at that in your career, do you mind explaining for us, like, what does it mean to study and build and figure out different methodologies within the historical context? Because, yeah, we're not really used to hearing that word associated with history. We usually think science.
Yeah. So, I mean, what typifies ancient history is a paucity of evidence, right? I mean, compared to, I'm in both a history and a classics department, and compared with my history colleagues, the amount of information that I have at my fingertips is a fraction of what even a medieval historian, let alone a 20th century American historian, can have access to. So you need to find the right tools to extract as much information out of these tiny little glints of evidence as you can. And there are a variety of ways of doing this. And one which, as I mentioned earlier, I think is becoming now more standard, but what wasn't always, is archaeology, is thinking about literary sources and material culture. But there are pitfalls with that, right? Because why should we assume that one little pot, you know, that we find in a ploughed field has anything to do with one of the few events that Thucydides thought to recount one day? So, you know, there are a whole set of, I would say, rules. Now, it's a little, actually, I shouldn't talk about differences with science because I was never very good at science. So scientific methodology may be just as subjective as historical methodology. But the point I want to make about historical methodology is there's no hard and fast rules. But what we're setting up is a series of likelihoods, of questions that you have to ask yourself when you're engaging with evidence, whether it's literary evidence, whether it's material evidence. One of the most obvious being, when does it date? Right? I mean, that, you know, people think that archaeologists have almost an obsession with dating, but it's an important part, obviously, of what they do if they're telling a story. But when it comes to literary sources, particularly if you're looking at the earlier part of Greek history, the archaic period, there are very, very few contemporary sources. Right. What we do have are a few. We have the Homeric epics, and we have Hesiod, and then really it's just fragments of lyric poets and so on. No kind of continuous accounts. When we do find fuller information, these are by authors who are writing centuries later. You know, people like Plutarch or Pausanias, right? You know, writing in AD centuries. So, you know, that's something. Now, it doesn't mean they're necessarily making it up, but then you have to sort of ask yourself a whole series of questions about, would they have reason to make this up by considering the context in which they're writing rather than the context of the events that they're describing? And also something one question I like to ask myself is, how invested are these authors in you accepting what they say? Right? Because sometimes it's the throwaway information, right? Those are the sorts of items of information that they just assume people are going to sort of take as given, right? It's when they get really hot under their collar and really try insisting on something that then you have to be perhaps a little more suspicious about what they're trying to tell you.
I mean, hey, it's very valid because one of the things that I encountered as a student was always, for whatever reason, and I don't know why, I wonder if it was just the classes I chose and the order I chose them, but I had to read either all of or parts of the Iliad, Odyssey, and Aeneid about 6 or 7 different times, which is a lot. Yeah, I was like, I love these things, but there's only so many times you can read them and say the same things about them. So I was like, okay. But yeah, I think because I remember it stands out as a very clear memory, but somebody in a class of mine when we were studying the Aeneid basically was positing that, oh, no, it makes sense, of course. Like, this is super, it's right, it makes sense. I don't remember exactly what the argument was. I have to ask this person. I'm still friends with them, luckily. But basically, they didn't take into account in their analysis the time that it was being written. And I remember somebody in class just spoke up and said, well, I mean, yeah, but there was a political agenda by Virgil. I was like, he wanted Augustus to like him. He wanted to set up this whole thing and be successful. And I remember everyone was kind of just like, oh, wait, right. Virgil was not right. He was writing. He had a political agenda. And it was sort of completely forgotten. And then it led to some great discussions on, well, did Homer, or if he was even one person, did he have a political agenda? When was Homer writing? And it brought up all these really great questions. And so, yeah, it's methodology can be fun. I know a lot of people who didn't like it so much, but I think it matters, right? You have to find it, discover it, and how fun it can be in the right context. Because I think if you're just sort of presented with something and say, okay, build me a methodology and go forth and have fun, that might not really be as fun. But it's really interesting to hear, and it's really interesting to hear how it differs. I mean, I chose not to go in ancient history for my graduate degree, so I have limited experience using the ancient materials. I was working more with modern political stuff, so methodology is completely different there. But it's nice to hear how it can be fun and how it's used in a different context, and I think it helps contextualize the study of ancient history and how archaeologists and other people go about their work, which is something I'm always very, very curious to learn more about since I didn't go into that. But I kind of want to rewind a little bit because I really enjoy talking about the Dorian invasion and all these theories about, you know, what happened during the Dark Age. But we tend to only hear about that in classes, I feel like, or maybe it's just it comes up as a random trivia fact or someone random just brings it up. We are, as humans, we love mysteries and we love conspiracy. Why, in your opinion, do we not have a lot of different media representations of the Dorian invasion or the Dorian period or whatever people want to call it? I mean, we have a billion films like 300 and all these other great films and TV shows and plays and books even that describe all these glorious battles, which obviously people like battles. I get it. People like natural disasters. Why do we not have anything on the Dorians? Like, It is a great mystery.
I have no idea. I mean, it's a very valid question to which I have no answer, other than to say that there is a kind of tacit celebration of Dorianness in 300, simply because the Spartans were thought to be uber Dorians. In other words, all Dorians were thought of as being somewhat kind of austere and courageous and manly and stout. You know, I mean, this is why Doric is the term given to a stout column as opposed to the sort of more effete Ionic column, right? And it's just that the Spartans embodied these kinds of stereotypical principles to the highest degree. So I think, you know, there is a certain amount of that lurking beneath the background. I think one possible answer is that at the time that I came to write my dissertation and my first book, which talked about the Dorians a lot, the Dorians had really fallen out of favor. And again, it's partly due to this very tight connection with Sparta, but it's also due to a strain of German Romantic thinking that started in the 19th century, but was taken to quite extremes towards the end of the 19th century, and obviously into the Third Reich, where Germans started identifying very heavily with Dorians, even to the extent that they posited that the original homeland of the Dorians wasn't actually northern Greece. It was much more north than that. It was in Germany. And you know, Hitler himself pointed to this peasant soup in Schleswig-Holstein, which apparently was made of sort of blood sausage, and said, you see, this is exactly what the Spartans used to eat, the famous black broth that formed the diet of the Spartans. So you know, this sort of interest in the Dorians, an interest that was phrased in predominantly racial terms, to go back to our earlier conversation, I think discredited the whole study or even interest in the Dorians for decades. And it was only really when social anthropologists gave us new tools to think about ethnicity and the constructed nature of ethnic groups that we could actually then start talking about Dorians again.
Interesting. And I think that ended up being very different than what I was expecting, which was, it might just because, you know, it's so hard. We don't have one firm strand of evidence. We can't put it together in a nice, pretty bow the way we can narratively just tell the story of the Persian War or something.
That hasn't stopped filmmakers in the past, has it?
No, you're right. If anything, having fewer, you know, points of historical accuracy and evidence would actually just make for a better fantasy story, maybe. But, and it's interesting how a part of Greek history gets wrapped up in Nazi ideology and propaganda and all that Spartan stuff. I feel like someone told me once that Hitler himself was a classicist, interested in classical things. It's very interesting. I guess I hadn't realized how much the Dorian culture had seeped into Sparta. Yeah, okay, well, I was trying to think of like three questions at once, and then of course I lost all of them. Oops.
Well, I was actually reading an article recently by, I think it was Eleftheria Yiannadou, drawing attention to the fact that in the early 40s, I forget which year exactly, Nazi troops recreated the Battle of Thermopylae. Right? I mean, they actually went to Thermopylae, which incidentally had been excavated just a few years later by a Greek dictator named Yanis Metaxas. But the Nazi troops, when they were occupying Greece, they sort of restaged the Battle of Thermopylae. And there are pictures that exist of this. And I'm not quite sure who they recruited to play the Persians, but the Persians were all dressed up in, of all things, African costumes. Right. I mean, so it was very, very heavily racialized. And the Spartans, you know, the Spartans are a fascinating, I'm actually teaching a course this winter on the Spartans. I mean, they're a fascinating subject, particularly from the methodological point of view, because so much that is thought about Sparta is totally fake, bogus, invented, etc., etc. But they're also deeply problematic for the ways that they've been used or abused, I should say, by subsequent historical generations.
Which is tragic. It's so tragic. It's something I talk about frequently, which is I hate how people feel free to use and abuse ancient history to have it suit their own agenda, I suppose. But then again, I guess that then goes to the larger question of, you know, will we ever be capable of non-politicizing history and not using it to serve a greater agenda? And I guess I'm pretty cynical about it because I think no, but I mean, do you believe that there would be a way to have some type of more universal objective history that's not just so twisted?
No. There are really two questions there. I don't think that some sort of universal objective history can exist, and I'm not sure that I actually want it to exist, because it seems to me if history is going to remain relevant, it has to be because it is a dialogue between present and past, right? We are inevitably going to interpret the past in ways that make sense in the present. The only thing we have to do, though, and if we didn't, it wouldn't mean anything to us, right? If we interpreted the past in its own terms, which are probably incommensurable with our norms and ideals and so on, it wouldn't make much sense. So we do this. This is why a history of the Greek world written by, you know, Jeremy McInerney in this decade is going to look very, very different from one that's written by George Grote or let alone a German historian like Berve or so on. So, and that's okay, I think, as long as we're upfront about it, as long as we're open and transparent about how we are interpreting the past. When it becomes insidious is when you're using it, as you say, for your own purposes, but try to conceal that, try to dissimulate that this is somehow gospel truth that you're relaying to people, all right? Whereas, I mean, we just have to say that all historical interpretations are essentially contingent. And they'll be replaced by different historical interpretations that will mean different things for future generations.
Well, that's something new to think about that I hadn't thought about. It definitely makes sense. It definitely just seems that it's more contingent than ever on humans to just reform ourselves.
And that's why history is a humanistic discipline.
Well, it definitely makes sense there. Absolutely makes sense there. But basically, I could go on and ask so many more questions, but obviously we would be here for the next 10 years. So I won't. I'll control myself. But there are three questions I generally just want to ask to sort of end the interview portion of the podcast, which is when you were a student, either an undergrad or in grad school, did you attend office hours?
No, there really wasn't. If by office hours you mean a designated time that's the same time every week, no, there wasn't. Oxford and Cambridge, for that matter, proceed most of lectures are entirely voluntary. And many people don't, or didn't, as I should say, go to lectures if they were particularly early in the morning, for instance. But the main mode of instruction is via tutorials, which are one-on-one or two-on-one. So that's sort of the equivalent of an office hour, right? Because you will have prepared an essay that you read out and you'll talk about it, but you can talk about other issues as well. And then when it comes to graduate level, then usually when you finish a chapter, you make an appointment with your supervisor. And that sort of serves as an office hour. But no, in terms of regular, there may be now, but it's certainly not when I was at university.
Okay. Well, and I suppose for the second question, you can answer it now in your capacity as a professor in the American system, which does have office hours. Do you have like a specific conversation or memory or something fun that stands out from an office hour conversation?
Well, I would say, I mean, I actually find myself sitting on my own for most of office hours. And students generally only tend to come if a paper is due. So if I'm thinking about moments where I actually could genuinely say, you know, that was just such a fascinating time. There was occasion actually a few weeks back. Where a couple of students just showed up and they didn't really, I mean, they were sort of talking about the paper, but the paper was still distant enough that they didn't have any specific questions about it. But it really just became a sort of free form meditation about the ancient world among two students, one of whom was a classics major, the other wasn't. She was actually a scientist, I think. But just, you know, really intelligent, fun conversation that went well beyond, I think, the hour that was designated.
Nice. Okay. That's fun when you have, you know, random fun conversations pop up. Well, and then the last question is, as an educator, if you had to give like a elevator pitch to students for why they should come to office hours, you know, what would you say to them?
Oh, well, I would like to persuade them that I have all sorts of techniques to communicate my enthusiasm for the ancient world, and they're far more interesting than just sort of saying, what does an essay look like? I mean, you know, I understand that that's important as well. You know, if they need help with their papers and so on, but really, that, you know, there's so much to discuss about the ancient world that I can't possibly fit into 3 hours of classes in a week, and office hours would be the obvious place to sort of spill over disseminate some of that additional material and thought.
Yeah, you get great conversation, kind of off the cuff. You get to know professor, and if you were my professor, she had the famous departmental chocolate drawer. So I basically, part of the reason I was always running up there is I wanted a handful of chocolate. And as long as she was there and the office was open, we could get that. And the nice part is she left it open for classic students and people who are in the department. If you just happen to be a student from anywhere and you wanted chocolate, she would offer you some chocolate. And yeah.
Well, our administrative assistant takes on that role in our department.
I mean, I feel like we're always trying to figure out creative ways to lure students to come talk to us, right? But anyway, so at the end of each podcast, I ask if every guest will read Shelley's beautiful Ozymandias poem. And after you've read the poem, I'm interested to know, you know, what you think about this poem, because this is consistently usually cited as a very influential poem. And I've heard people say things like, it stood the test of time because it's so relevant today. Or I've heard people say, I don't really know. It seems pretty ancient and I don't like poetry. So there's so many different ways to interpret poetry. Yeah, I'm just curious to know what you think of it. And, you know, has it stood the test of time? And why do you think people always come back to it as something of great importance?
All right.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
I met a traveller from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the sand, half-sunk a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things. The hand that mocked them, and the heart that fed, and on the pedestal these words appear. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. At first glance, one gets the impression that this is a meditation on, I guess, you know, transient ephemerality, the transient ephemerality of human deeds. There's, you know, the whole talking about these the fragments of these statues as lifeless, and this sort of aura of decay and devastation and desolation. I mean, a lot of it is not unlike some of the early poetry of Shelley's on again, off again friend Byron, right? Although here it's situated in Egypt rather than the Greek landscape. And when you mentioned whether the poem itself sort of still remains relevant, I mean, I suppose the sort of distinction that one's drawing is that ancient trope between, we could call it materialism and idealism, or between words and things, right? I mean, one thinks of Horace's description of his odes, right, as a monumentum aere perennius, a monument more lasting than bronze. But I think actually the poem rather pushes back against those sorts of interpretations. First, because in a certain sense, this isn't really Shelley's monumentum, right? It's focalized not through the poetic eye, but through this anonymous traveler, right? He's the one who's talking about it. And secondly, at the end of the day, this statue of Ozymandias may not be intact, but it has at least partially survived the ravages of time, right? And not only that, but its materiality is what generates the observations of the foreign traveler, which is what generates the sonnet. So, you know, this sort of the poem itself isn't necessarily what is the monumentum aere perennius. I think what I take away from this is not so much a sense of temporality as a meditation on agency, right? It's that you or I, any historical individual, ultimately doesn't get to write the narrative, doesn't get to control the narrative. It's all right, you know, Ozymandias has his own ideas about his place in the world and the wonderful monuments that he's constructed, but it's almost immediately subverted by the hand of the sculptor. And then it's subverted further by the passage of time and the fact that most of the rest of these monuments have been swallowed up by the encroaching sand.
Well, that is definitely spot on. I completely agree, and I definitely do look at this poem as a very political statement on, as you said, ephemerality, of political power, and other things. And it brings up these serious questions about monumentality, what sticks, what doesn't. And, you know, I think it just basically is one nice, neat 14-line memento mori, basically reminding people that, well, you're all doomed to die. So pip, pip, you know, work together, do as best you can. But in the end, yeah, you don't have any control over how things will shake out. And having this great idea of what this poem stands for, then the last question I like to ask every guest is, if we consider our contemporary society right now, do we have a type of modern Ozymandias in the world, something that we think is so great and amazing and it'll last forever because it's monumental? Or will we look back at something and say, well, what were we thinking? This was completely stupid and ridiculous, and I don't know why we thought this was a great idea.
So I don't think it takes a huge stretch of the imagination to call to mind powerful, hubristic narcissists who are obsessed with their own standing in the world and their own place in history, their legacy, if you like, but whom I'm pretty sure will be remembered by history in rather different ways to how they hope they're going to be imagined. I think I don't need to say any more, do I?
No. I mean, that could be three or four different people. Actually, it could be a lot more than that. So
a lot more.
We can just categorize it to that archetype of a person, and 10,000 people will pop up. Yes, basically. Yeah, great answer. Great answer. And then I kind of lied to you because the actual last questions I wanted to ask are, where can people find you if they would like to follow your work or, I don't know, contact you to see if they could, you know, study something related to what you've worked on in your career?
Okay, well, I'm not a creature of social media, but I am contactable by email, and that can be found on my webpage in either the Department of History or the Department of Classics at the University of Chicago.
Great. Well, we will make sure to put all the relevant links in. And if I remember correctly, you had a book that's relatively recent. Last year, was it?
Yeah.
Okay. And we can link that as well, so people can find your book as well.
That would be great. That's really a book about more about modern Greece than ancient Greece, but it was a lot of fun.
Great. Well, thank you so much again for joining me. It's been really, really fun getting to talk a little more in depth about methodology and other wonderful topics that I don't really get to talk about very often at all. So, I hope to have you back on in some capacity in the future.
Look forward to it. Thanks, Lexi.
Trireme Transit is now departing ancient office hours. Next stop is Present Ponderings.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Your personal info, like addresses, phone numbers, and more, are collected and sold by data brokers. But Aura steps in, scanning the web, sending you alerts, and requesting your info be removed. Get Aura's full toolkit, including credit and transaction monitoring, a password manager, VPN, and more. Get a 14-day free trial at Aura.com/safety. That's AURA.com/safety.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.